From the Danker studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going to have a conversation with two of the authors of a new study examining the massive landslide at Utah's Kennecott copper mine last year, which it turns out was the largest non-volcanic landslide in modern history.
The deposit would cover New York City's Central Park with 66 feet of debris. Something more local, it would cover Liberty Park in 545 feet of debris.
That conversation, a look at a request from the Human Rights Campaign to the U.S. Attorney General's office seeking federal recognition of Utah's same-sex marriages, and your summary of the day's top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once more for tuning in to KCPW's news and issues show, The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later, we're going to look at a new study from the University of Utah that examined the massive Kennecott copper landslide from last year and uncovered some interesting results. But first up, we have these headlines. The nation's largest gay rights group is asking the federal government to recognize same-sex couples who married in Utah before the U.S. Supreme Court put these marriages on hold. The court's decision has created confusion for more than 1,000 couples. In a letter obtained by the Associated Press, the Human Rights Campaign asks U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to allow those couples to receive federal benefits. The Human Rights Campaign also sent letters to the attorneys general of 17 states where same-sex marriage is legal in the United States, asking them to recognize the Utah marriages as well. The letters came just one day after Utah Governor Gary Herbert instructed state agencies to hold off on processing any new benefits for the newly married couples. There's been no response yet from any of the attorneys general in states where same-sex marriage is legal. A Department of Justice official contacted by KCPW acknowledged that the Human Rights Campaign's letter had been received by the U.S. Attorney General's office, but provided no further comment. A committee of lawmakers investigating former Attorney General John Swallow is meeting next week to discuss possible changes to state campaign laws. Taylorsville Republican Jim Dunnigan says the House Investigative Committee is scheduled to meet Tuesday, and we'll hear a presentation from the Lieutenant Governor's office about their investigation of Swallow. Dunnigan says the committee will then consider whether election laws need to be changed in light of the findings. Republican Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, whose office oversees elections, announced in November that his office found Swallow likely violated campaign disclosure laws during his 2012 campaign. Cox declined to pursue penalties because Swallow had announced his resignation. Swallow, a Republican, cited the toll of the investigations on his family as a reason for stepping down and denied any wrongdoing. The House Investigative Committee wound down their probe last month. The batteries that power our electronic devices contain heavy metals and other materials that are toxic to the environment. A new battery technology inspired by biology, called biobatteries, overcomes many of these problems. The technology may one day lead to biodegradable batteries that store energy more efficiently than today's heavy-duty lithium-ion batteries. Kim Shusky of Explore Utah Science has the story.
Most electronic devices we use today, like cell phones and computers, use lithium-ion batteries for their power. These batteries can store a lot of energy, leading to longer use times before recharging than other battery types. But the metals and chemicals used in lithium-ion batteries can be dangerous.
Interestingly enough, if something makes a very high energy density battery, it oftentimes has, it's a very energetic material and can have sort of safety issues associated with that. And we see that with lithium ion. So you've seen the reports of people's laptops catching on fire, issues with cars, et cetera.
That's Shelley Mentir. She's a U-Star professor of chemistry and material science and engineering at the University of Utah. To keep these batteries safe means they have to be packaged very carefully. And other safety mechanisms, such as a temperature sensor, have to be included so they don't overheat.
Because lithium is sort of dangerous chemistry, so the container itself, the protective container, takes up a certain amount of space. And so we are basically hitting the limit, taking into account that we have to have the protective cases.
As electronics continue to advance, they need higher battery capacities. But safety concerns and other technological considerations mean that it may not be long before lithium-ion batteries can no longer keep up. This has led to an explosion of research into the development of whole new types of batteries.
So it used to be that we were okay with a cell phone that we use sporadically, and now we need our cell phone to take videos, to take pictures, to have a color screen, and all these things require energy. And so we have had to sort of change how we think about designing batteries to be able to design those for the applications that people want to use them today.
Mintir is on the forefront of battery technology. Her lab is developing biodegradable batteries that contain no toxic metals or chemicals.
We are making batteries that are, for all intents and purposes, edible. Not that we eat them, but they are edible.
She says her batteries are inspired by biology, since every day we consume food and cells in our bodies convert that food into energy.
The powerhouse of the living cell, or the energy conversion component of the living cell, happens in the mitochondria. And so we either remove the mitochondria intact
from yeast, spinach, or potatoes,
and put it on an electrode surface, or we remove the part of the mitochondria, the actual enzymes or catalyst in the mitochondria that do energy conversion from the cell, and put them on the electrode surface.
The fuel for this type of battery is not a dangerous chemical, but instead can be the same kind of things that we ingest, like sugar or alcohol. The mitochondria or enzymes convert the fuel into electrical energy.
We have technology that we know is extremely efficient in the living cell. And if we can get that kind of efficiency, we would have energy densities that are over an order of magnitude, or roughly 20 times as energy dense as lithium-ion batteries. But we haven't yet got that complete efficiency that you see in the living cell. And so we're working on how we can improve that.
Currently, biobatteries are able to generate high enough current densities to power many portable electronic devices.
So you're typically talking about lifetimes that are on the days to weeks range for mitochondria, so relatively short. On the other hand, with enzymes, it really depends on what we do to protect the enzymes. So if we protect the enzymes from degradation, we can get months to years worth of life out of the enzyme. Similar lifetimes to what you would get out of a lot of your sort of traditional battery technologies.
The benefits of a biobattery are obvious in terms of disposal. It's estimated that Americans throw away 358 million pounds of batteries every year, dispersing toxic materials into our air, water, and soil. But there are also specific applications that could be more suitable for a biobattery. Imagine a pacemaker that runs on a battery that uses the sugar in a person's bloodstream. Or since the batteries can be made flexible, they could be used in wearable electronics. Mintir says some applications will take longer to develop than others, but expects to see simple applications come out within a couple of years.
Some applications, like, for instance, using biodegradable batteries in a greeting card, doesn't require a lot of engineering. If instead you look at the battery that is in your cell phone, the battery in your cell phone is a smart device. And so any type of smart battery that requires a great deal of power management is longer down the engineering scale than something that can just use the energy as it comes directly out of the battery.
So the next time you open a greeting card like this one, it's just possible that you might be using a biobattery. For KCPW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
Utah is seeking federal approval for plans to curb chronic air pollution along an urban corridor of 2 million residents. State regulators put final touches on the plans Wednesday by adopting deadlines for new industrial emissions controls along the Wasatch Front. The plans are taking effect in state law, even as regulators submit them to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for approval. The EPA says it's working closely with Utah and expects to improve the plans. That review process could take months. Clean air advocates say Utah gave industry too much time to install new pollution controls. They are hoping that the EPA speeds up some of its deadlines. The plans aren't designed to achieve federal air quality standards until 2019 at the earliest. By then, Utah may have to find ways to cut emissions further as the federal government tightens air quality standards. More on that topic next week when we have a conversation with Brian Mensch of the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And those are our top local stories for the day. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. The enormous landslide at Kennecott Copper Mine last year was likely the largest non-volcanic slide in North American history and the first known to have triggered earthquakes. This, according to a study by University of Utah scientists published earlier this week in the Geological Society of America's magazine, GSA Today. We're joined by two of the researchers who were involved in the study, Chris Panko and Jeff Moore. Thanks to you both for coming in today.
Thank you.
The landslide happened the night of April 10th of last year and was successfully forecast. Kennecott was able to predict that it was going to happen, and that resulted in no fatalities or injuries. Do you know what caused the landslide?
That's a kind of a question that's outside of what we're doing here so much. And what I could say is that this was a creeping bedrock landslide that developed, you know, it developed over many months.
Okay.
And as such, it was carefully monitored by the mine, who operates, you know, a network of all the latest technologies in geotechnical monitoring. And these, in fact, were quite successful in forecasting that the failure was imminent and then forecasting the time of failure.
And that forecasting allowed the sort of avoiding of casualties as a result.
Yeah, that's right. They're able to track the deformation of the ground using all this different equipment. And when it reaches certain levels of movement, they're able to sort of issue warnings and eventually evacuate people so that when it did fail, everybody was out of the way.
How big, if you can describe it, how big was this landslide? Maybe you can put it into context.
Yeah, so the scale of the slide is remarkable in terms of, you know, events that we see. As you said, it's the largest non-volcanic landslide in North American history. There are larger slides in the prehistoric record, in the geological record, that is. And the context, the scale is a little bit hard to grasp because, you know, it happened in such a massive mine. And the things that we see in the images are also the big haul trucks. And these are all scaled up from what we're normally used to. In terms of, you know, context that we can appreciate, we note in the paper there that the deposit would cover New York City's Central Park with 66 feet of debris. Something more local, it would cover Liberty Park in 545 feet of debris.
The study also found that the slide triggered 16 small earthquakes. Is that a common thing for slides to do, or for, I guess, non-volcanic slides to do?
To our knowledge, it's the first time a landslide has... Well, it's the first documented case of a landslide triggering earthquakes. And to put these earthquakes in context, these are very small events that are happening right under the slide. So these aren't changing our seismic hazard here. They're more a response to moving mass and the crust readjusting. Just to be clear on that these are small earthquakes localized to the pit, and it's just our hypothesis is it's a readjustment of the crust.
They're not things that you would feel a long ways away or even here in Salt Lake Valley.
No. The largest was a magnitude, what we call a Coda magnitude 3, which if you were right there, you might have said, wow, something happened. Mm-hmm. But the majority of these events were between minus 0.8 and 0.5. So these are... slip on very small areas, very small magnitudes. So,
we say non-volcanic landslides, and I guess volcanic landslides are those that are caused by volcanoes.
Yeah, so we just have to put this caveat in here when we talk about North American landslides, because the Mount St. Helens eruption and landslide was just orders of magnitude larger than this one, and it's orders of magnitude larger than many events that are happening in the world. That was a truly massive, massive event. It's going to be a long time before we live up to that scale again. So we throw that caveat in front, you know, and sort of separate that volcanic events out from non-volcanic landslides.
Are there other natural events that can cause earthquakes?
Yes. So we haven't seen it. Usually earthquakes cause landslides. So that's one thing that's a distinction here is there's many earthquakes that we can say were caused because of an earthquake. The ground shaking destabilized the ground and you have a landslide. So this was unusual in that it was the landslide that actually caused the small earthquake. So it sort of turned our thinking around a little bit.
Yeah.
We also know that large earthquakes can trigger small earthquakes hundreds of kilometers away. And a good example of this was the Denali Fault earthquake actually increased the seismicity in Utah for 26 days.
Wow.
So, again, these are really small earthquakes, but there was a clear statistically significant increase from the passage of the surface waves. And that particular earthquake, the Denali Fault earthquake, also induced or triggered seismicity in Yellowstone National Park, in parts of Idaho, Nevada, and California. So it was – and we've seen this over and over again. So
a spreading of earthquake activity from one sort of central point, and then it's kind of a ripple effect?
I wish we knew what it was. The first documented case of this was following the 1992 Landers event. And before 1992, if you would have asked any seismologist, can an earthquake trigger events hundreds of kilometers away, we would have said no way. But Landers and then a number of smaller cases of triggering and then Denali really showed that the surface waves, when they come through, can change the stress state. And it probably has something to do with the state of stress in the crust. If you're critically stressed already, maybe small perturbations will cause these small earthquakes. But it's an area of active research.
Wow. But the slides themselves were really, you described them as rock avalanches. Is that right?
That's right. Rock avalanches are a particular type of landslide, distinguished by their extremely rapid and flow-like run-out motion. So they travel very fast, and they travel very far, and much farther than you would see or expect that a normal landslide or rockfall deposit might build up. Where those smaller events typically build up, steep slope angles close to the angle of repose at the base of the cliffs. We've seen a lot of these hanging around in the mountains along road cuts. Different to rock avalanches is that they're traveling very fast and they have this sort of unique flow-like character of the motion. You can see some of this in some of the photos of the slide deposit. You can see these kind of transverse flow bands and longitudinal features and a lot of features that look just to your eye, flow-like. Events like this are rare. Rock avalanches of this scale are rare. And initially, they sort of took people by surprise. And back in the 1800s, there's a case history from Switzerland where there was actually a mining-induced rock avalanche in Elm, Switzerland. And they were cutting slate from a hill slope, and they thought, well, they saw some cracks developing on the back, and they thought, well, okay, this will fail, but when it does, it'll build up this steep deposit, and we'll carry on mining somewhere else. And they didn't expect that when this huge volume failed all at once, that it would transition into this flow-like run-out mass, which in fact engulfed the town and killed 118 people.
Wow.
And really unique about that event at the time in the late 1800s was that it was a time when people were sort of treating these events as things for scientific investigation rather than something that just was an act of God that happened one day.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be one of the first cases where people realize that, okay, this rock avalanche is a unique kind of landslide with this fast, far, and flow-like run-out. And that this behavior is real and can be expected. So it's expected for very large volumes that fail all at once. You know, here at the Bingham Pit, we had this 65 million cubic meters that failed in two main episodes.
Okay.
So if it would have failed in one main episode, it would have had the same kind of behavior and probably attained higher velocities and maybe sort of rammed into the pit wall for all we know. On the other hand, if it would have failed in 20 episodes over several hours, it would have been a completely different beast.
Mm.
It could have, built the steep deposit that we are more familiar with seeing, and it would have maybe spared some of the haul trucks that were damaged. It might have spared some of the shovels that were damaged. So in practice, predicting how it will fail is very difficult. We could know that you have this volume of rock in motion. You can see this with monitoring instruments and know the volume well. But to say, this will fail as one event or as 20 events, this is very hard to predict.
But would be obviously very useful if you could. So these rock avalanches, you could detect those as though they were an earthquake by themselves through a seismograph.
Yeah, the landslides or the rock avalanches leave a seismic signal. And some researchers at Columbia put out a paper earlier this year documenting a number of these that were recorded on a global network. And a global seismic network. But one of the things that made our analysis unique is we had a local seismic network. And so we were able to record more frequencies, so more of the energy was recorded locally than you can get recorded globally. And this event was actually recorded globally as well, so outside of Utah. But so unique to us is we have this incredibly rich and somewhat new data set. There have been small case studies, but a pretty unique data set of sort of high frequency or rich broadband data in terms of the frequencies of both seismic and acoustic infrasound data.
And that's just because of the proximity of the equipment to the site of the activity.
Very fortunate. So at seismograph stations, we monitor seismic activity in Utah. That's one of the things that we do, monitor seismic activity in Utah and Yellowstone National Park. And to do that, we have a number of seismometers here along the Wasatch Front, especially to monitor the Wasatch Fault.
Right. And I believe you have some audio of this that you were able to record that we have here to play. Could you maybe set up this recording for us?
So in the sound files, they're going to start, and you're going to hear a low rumbling noise, and it's that's the landslide. Now, this is not – you aren't hearing the landslide. You're hearing the seismic recording of the landslides that's been sped up, so it's in the audible range. Huh. And the landslide comes in as this low rumbling noise, and followed by that, you're going to hear what sounds more like popping noise, and you'll hear three pops, and those are a higher pitch sound – and they're shorter in duration, and that's very rapid. And those are the earthquakes. So the landslide comes in, and it's kind of emergent, and the sound builds up, but it has a low, rumbly sound. And then three sort of quick bangs, and and those are the earthquakes.
All right, then. Well, let's give a listen. That is some amazing audio. And again, that's the sound of the slide first, of the landslide at Kennecott, and then the earthquakes in succession thereafter. Just for a second, I'm gonna change directions here and say that it's a pretty comprehensive study you guys have done. I'm wondering how you carried out your investigation. For example, where does a lot of the data that you're getting come from? Is it coming from your own, you know, equipment? How involved is Kennecott?
You know, the kind of the core data that we're working with is coming from the seismograph stations. These are publicly available seismic data being recorded, cataloged, worked through in the day-to-day sense. And we're using those, you know, for this new purpose. But Kennecott has been, you know, after the slide, they have been fairly cooperative in sharing information. They put out, you know, all these excellent photos, described the event, described the monitoring techniques that they used, and they put a lot of information out following this. And this is to a certain extent because this was a success for them in that case in terms of monitoring, geotechnical monitoring, and preventing disaster through monitoring. This was a real success. Right. So I think in that case they were eager to share, you know, the details behind that. So some of the core data we're getting from Kennecott through their press releases and through their website and through things they release online.
Yeah. But I want to clarify, we aren't working collaboratively with Kennecott. Okay. So nothing in here. We have shared all of our findings with Kennecott.
But this is your own research.
This is our own research. Yeah. And they just, you know, they haven't blessed it. It hasn't gone through their review process. So this is our research, and we've pulled what we can off the web. And, you know, we've have conversations with them, but their main goal is to get back in business.
Sure, and yours is a obviously a scientific charge. Does the research you guys have done present any kind of warnings?
I don't know that there's an implicit warning, but I think what we hope is that it helps us maybe monitor landslides, other landslides that aren't being monitored, like with geotechnical equipment. So, you know, landslides that happen in the middle of nowhere. No one might know when it happened or the size or maybe the properties of that. And with seismic data, I think now we can get to at least the timing of that and maybe some of the information we learned from studying this particular landslide where we know how big it was and we have a really dense network of seismometers where we can really dig into the seismic data and look at sort of force histories and such. We might learn something that we can then apply to remote monitoring of landslides, so to provide more information.
Hmm. You know, I was thinking we've had other big – I mean, you guys actually addressed this in your study. We've had other big slides here in Utah, including the Thistle slide in 1983, and that was – up until this one, apparently – according to the release that you guys sent out, the most expensive slide in American history because of the relocation of a town.
The town, the railroad track, the highway, these were all destroyed and needed relocation, yeah.
Yeah, and then did this slide become the most expensive slide? I mean, did it sort of overtake it?
Well, to be clear, we don't have any of our own numbers on the cost of this slide. What we report in the article came from the media in the day, weeks and months after the slide, and these numbers are continually updating. I mean, even the Thistle slide, being the standing most expensive landslide in U.S. history, the numbers on that are vary by a factor of two. It's like $500 million to almost $1 billion in costs. Those are adjusted for inflation. So that's kind of gives you an idea of how well we can constrain these costs. I mean, it's one thing to estimate direct costs, direct losses from the landslide. That's easily done. But the indirect losses are much harder to calculate and take a while to sort of emerge, I think.
Sure. Yeah, imagine the cost of what could have happened in the town, for the next few decades. So as researchers and engineers and mine companies, as these guys – make their plans into the future. Is there does this study help them with that? The thought of planning. Is that part of the hope? Is to allow them to better plan?
Not sure how it directly relates to the mine companies. I mean, some things that we've been able to provide Kennecott because we had seismic data, we can look at the actual ground motions. So the ground motions from the landslide are a little bit different than ground motions from earthquakes. They're somewhat comparable, but just to know how – so you have the landslide, but because the energy was coupling into the ground, you have shaking just like an earthquake. And so what was that shaking like? We can comment on information like that. I think we'll be able to look maybe at the force history, but in terms of that playing into their mine plan, probably not. But to clarify this, the mine did everything they could. They invested – large amounts of money to have the best monitoring equipment. Mm-hmm. And I think from the mine standpoint, maybe Kennecott showed the rest of the mining community that was money well spent.
Right. Go ahead.
I would comment that, as Chris mentioned, I think one of the sort of important outcomes of this study is that using seismic data to analyze landslide hazards is a real kind of a new emerging field. And I think there's a lot of power there. I mean, the University of Utah Seismograph Stations network is expansive across Utah, and it's excellent within Utah. And to be able to use that existing data to identify that there might have been a rock fall somewhere in the San Rafael Swell, for example, and when that was, or, to try to invent new uses for these existing data, it can be quite valuable. And I think we're really just beginning to explore how quantitative we can get with that.
I think we're going to end on that. As usually happens, we've run out of time before we can address a great deal that shows up in your study. But I want to thank you both for coming in and joining me today. Chris Pankow and Jeff Moore are two of the authors of a new study about last year's April 10th massive landslide at Kennecott Copper. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning in to KCPW's news and issues show, The Rundown. Our program was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, Aaron Gus, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 p.m. for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.